Hi, is this Tabitha?
It is. How are you doing?
I'm good. It's Bree. How are you?
I am well, thanks. Thanks for letting me shift the time.
Yeah, no. I mean, is y'all okay with the storm?
I think so. It's totally spring in Oklahoma. There's always a tornado watch. You just live that way.
I give you props because I would lose my mind.
Time. We kind of live on a hill, and it tends to kind of follow the valleys and things like that. So we don't get anything very close to us normally, but yeah, it can be scary. So
are you native to Oklahoma? Is that where you are from?
My husband and I both grew up in Iowa and then ended up in Oklahoma, and then we've been a few places since then, but we keep ending up back in Oklahoma. So
was that because of horses though, or why did you?
Yes. Yeah. Originally it wasn't. I knew I didn't want to live in Iowa. I absolutely hate it. I don't like anything about Iowa. I hate to say that, but they have a fairly large horse culture, but it's nothing like being in these southern states as far as, you know, tax stores and events and all that kind of stuff. And I am not a cold weather girl. So, the cold in Iowa just killed me. So I did graphic design originally in college because my dad was bound and determined I was not going to be a horse trainer. And I actually took
I saw that. No, I saw that. You do some good stuff. I think you spoke about some stuff you did.
Yes. And I still do some on the side, but that's what brought us to Oklahoma, actually, is I took a graphic design job down here in Oklahoma with a company in Tulsa. So that's what got us started down here. And then since then, we've lived a couple of different places, but now I just train horses full time in Oklahoma. So
that, you know what, everybody I talk to that's like from north, like above the line, like northern states like that, they either, you have to really, really love it or they end up migrating down.
Right. We joke that they just don't know any better.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, I don't know how some of them do it, especially having farm animals. I like animals and that, like horses and cows and things like that. I don't know how they do it.
I couldn't do it. Like, I have no desire to go back. And they still get, a lot of those states still get the heat and the bugs and all the same stuff that we do, and they have to deal with the cold winters. So, I don't see the appeal.
No, I'm good. I saw a debate about it where people were like, don't complain about the cold. I will complain about it. I mean, like, I don't have a problem doing it, but who wants to do that?
Yeah, me too. And I try not to complain in the summer. We do get brutal summers down here, but I can deal with the heat. I cannot deal with the cold. So
now, do you primarily focus on, now all I see is mules for the most part. Do you primarily focus on mules or do you venture off of that at all?
I grew up in the horse world. That's all I did was horses. And it's kind of a joke. I figured this was my karma because when I was a kid, there was one boy that rode our school bus that had mules, and I used to make fun of him for riding mules. So I think that's how I ended up in this. So, but no, we ended up in here totally by accident. We rode quarter horses and paints for a long time, all rounds, mostly Western pleasure, English pleasure, and some reining. And when we were just starting out, I said I was down here doing graphic design, and I had a freelance graphic design customer, and I went to his house to take some pictures, and I had some wind pictures from that weekend's show laying on the dash of my truck, and he said, oh, you guys train horses, and I said, yeah, that's what we do mostly. I just kind of do the graphic design thing on the side, and he said, well, I've got this donkey, and, we were just young starting out, and I figured if his check would clear, then we'd take his donkey. So I told him, I said, we've never done that before, but I said, we'll try it. And I really attribute most of our success in the mule and donkey industry to my naivety about that, because we brought that donkey home and, you know, we looked at the show bill for the next donkey show and it had all the same classes as our horses. So I just went to training him just like we did our horses. So by the time we got to the show, I had this jack to where he'd ride around one-handed, he'd walk trot low, he'd step off into both his leads. I mean, he'd ride around like a horse. And at the time, this was, you know, 15, 20 years ago, at the time, donkeys weren't riding like that. If they could get...
Well, I was fixing to say, they made a big comeup because, well, I just turned 40, but probably in the same era you're talking about. Back when I used to show, you didn't see donkey, like, and mules and none of that. No, nobody did that. It was like... out there, and now it's everywhere.
Yes, and it's one of the reasons we were so successful. Like, I don't think it was that we were that much better than anybody else at all. I think that we didn't have any preconceived notions about what we were going to see when we got to the show. So I think a lot of the mule and donkey people had kind of gotten used to not having to work real hard, and if the animal would just kind of ride around a little bit and not get in a wreck, then that was good enough. And then when we started going. We started out with the one jack, and he won everything. And then the same guy sent us a second jack, and I would ride one, and my husband would ride the other. And there was rarely a show that we weren't High Point and Reserve at, where a lot of times we'd win every class at the show. And so then people just gradually started sending us mules and donkeys, and it just kind of took over. And we love their personalities, and we really love the people involved. I mean, I'm so fortunate to where we're at now. And of course, we've done a lot of work between that and now, but most of my customers have been with me for a decade, and I've got a lot of mules that have been with me that long. And, you know, they always pay their bills on time. A lot, when we were training horses, I spent as much time, you know, collecting on bad checks and tracking down payments as I did riding the animals. So I just don't have that trouble in the mule and donkeys. It just is a little bit different people. And
well, I think you're in a good, I mean, like, you're in a good space, because most of people in the, let's say, equine market as a whole, they look at mules and donkeys like, no, no, no. And it helps kind of separate you from the people that are really actually serious about having them. Because, I mean, once you kind of go that route, it's just like gated horses. It's like once people get into mules, they don't ever go back.
Right. Well, I think what I hear my clients saying, especially, and a lot of those came from all different facets of the horse world, whether it be quarter horse or hunter jumper, reining, and they just like the atmospheres of the show. It's more welcoming. And what I love the most about the mule and donkey shows is everybody competes in the all round. It's not nearly as specialized. And I am one of those people that truly like to ride in a lot of different events. There really isn't much I haven't ridden in. We've rode cutting horses and reining horses and worked for Western Pleasure Trainers and some hunter jumper. And I like to do a little bit of everything. So it's fun for me to be able to take the same animal and show in those all-around events, kind of like, you know, quarter horse and paint used to be way back when, without just having to have a pleasure horse or a hunt seat horse or a trail horse. So we enjoy that a lot. Like I said, between the welcoming atmosphere and being able to kind of dip your toes in all the different events, it's a fun place to be.
That makes a big difference, I've heard, you know, and kind of seen throughout the whole horse world. Like, you know, if you've got an event or a place that's just not welcoming, it'll hurt you. Like, you've got to still kind of make it a little more fun and exciting, you know. Not everybody's a professional when it comes to this stuff, so.
Right. So everybody really helps each other out at the mule and donkey shows. I mean, it could be your biggest competitor, and if you have a piece of equipment break, or you didn't bring something or something like that right at the gate, like, everybody will run to get it for you and try to help, even though they might go in the ring and beat you, you know. So I think that's fun.
Well, I mean, you might can agree with me when I say this. When I used to show, which I don't now, I know I keep saying that, but when you entered the ring, you were competition. When you walked out, you left it in the ring, you know.
Yes.
It's simple as that, you know.
Absolutely.
So, but now, do you think, I've always wondered this, do you think that it's harder to train, is it harder for you to train a mule versus a horse? Do you have, like, what's the biggest difference between?
To me, it shifts. The difficultness of the training kind of shifts as you go. I think mules are harder to start, and donkeys as well. They're harder to get really following their nose and freed up in the shoulders and really turning. So 30 days on a mule is nothing compared to 30 days on a horse. And I feel like when I get them to the point, I can really lope them nice circles. Then it's a breeze. Everything from there just goes at a light speed. Then you can start adding events and tricks and things way faster than you can on a horse, and they have a lot better retention than a horse does, which can help you and hurt you. Mules do a lot better if they've been laid off for long periods. They just rarely forget anything. They'll come right back where you left them. But if you have a big wreck on one or make a big mistake, you can fight that too, because they do have long memories. I don't think it's a stubborn thing. They're very smart. It's more about they're always thinking. So if you're just saying, hey, go this way, where a horse will just go, okay, you asked me to go this, you know, you asked me to go right, I'm going to go right. The mule will go, instead of just going right, we'll first go, well, why are we going right? What's over there? Why might I let you do that? So it's not really a stubborn thing. It's more of a, you've kind of got to develop a partnership with them, and they're always thinking about why they're doing this and why they want to do this. And so it just makes for a challenge. But for me, it's a fun challenge, because sometimes you just have to stop what you're doing if it's not working and take a breath and think, how else can I, you know, how else can I ask this question or show them why we're doing this? So
Well, that's kind of a challenge. I mean, that would be a good thing to have that type of challenge, you know.
It is. It keeps you on your toes. And they've got such big personalities. I still enjoy riding my horses, there's no doubt. And horses are good for different things. But the mules have such big personalities, every single one of them, that it just, they really suck you in.
That's super cool because, I mean, I think it's cool to have that type of adversity in the show ring, you know, to be able to have a horse and a mule show together. I thought it was cool. And it kind of opens up people's eyes to the monotony of the horse world. Like, okay, we got a mule doing this now. You better up your game, you know?
It does. Yep, it really does. Yeah, we competed. We were one of the first people to take I don't know if there's been any other donkeys. I know there's been mules, but we, when the Western Dressage World was here in Tulsa, we took our Jack Clyde's Gallant Fox to it. It's been several years ago. And one of the classes we competed in was a dressage equitation class on the rail. And we made the finals. And then when they announced the final results, they started from 10 and got to 1. And when it got down to the last two, it was just me on this donkey and somebody on probably, you know, a $50,000 quarter horse mare. And we ended up second, which I was super proud of. But I thought,
holy cow!
I thought the guy on the quarter horse mirror was going to have a heart attack waiting to see what the results were. So it was super fun. But, yeah, we ended up reserve champion there. And there's not been another donkey that's done that. But, yeah, not even a mule, but a donkey. So that's really fun when you can show people what they're capable of.
Well, congrats there. That is pretty freaking cool. I mean,
thank you.
That is really cool. Now, so you have your judge's card too, right?
Yes. Yeah. I just got my ABRA with the Buckskin Association. I just got it this spring. I've judged for years and years and years. I actually, I've always had an interest in judging. I started judging on the Iowa State University collegiate team, and I actually won the performance and the reasons, and then was overall champion at Congress when I was judging collegiately, and then we judged at NRHA.
So wait, whoa, hold up. So you went to college in Iowa, I'm assuming, right?
I did. Yes.
Okay, and you did all of that there.
Yeah. Yes, and then from there, I judged a lot of open and 4-H shows, and I always thought, you know, I would go ahead and get some breed cards, and life just happens. I just had not taken the time. I wanted to make sure I had the time and money to dedicate to it, because there's a lot to getting your card. It really requires a commitment. And so I just kept judging a lot of open and 4-H shows and going to a lot of seminars. I really like to keep educating myself. And this fall, one of the ABRA judges committee members had scribed for me at an open show I was doing. And she asked me if I would apply. And I said, well, this is probably as good a time as any. So I went ahead and turned my card in and had a lot of good people mentoring me. And was very fortunate to go through it and get my card. So now I'd like to, you know, add some more associations. In April, I'm going to the APHA has a great program, a live judging seminar that they're doing in Fort Worth called Horse IQ. So I'm going to go down there for some more education and maybe work on a paint card next. So
how long does it take on average to get your judge's card?
Oh, if you just go through the process on one association, you're probably looking at a year by the time you've got to turn in your application and get all your references in and all that kind of stuff.
A year? Holy cow.
Well, I mean, really, by the time you do all that, and then depending on what the requirements are for each of the associations, and then normally you've got to require to attend some kind of seminar. The ABRA was at the Color Breed seminar in Tulsa that the Pinot puts on. They put on the main judges seminar, and then Paint and AQHA both have their own. So you've got to go through those seminars, and then you've got to go through the testing, which is usually anywhere from 6 to 12 video classes, and your scores are matched with the officials on that. So you've got to pass the video judging and then take a written test and also go through an interview process. And then it's usually ABRA was really nice. They let us know within just a couple of days if we had passed everything and we got our card or not. Some of the associations make you wait a month or two. So I was glad to know.
So it's not like, okay, so I think I'm uneducated in this whole, well, I am uneducated in this whole ordeal. So you don't have just one main kind of company that handles all judges' cards. Like if you wanted to go to a random open show that's not breed associated, you have to go to each association.
Correct, yes. And some you can get, like the seminar that I attended, they host multiple breeds. So they had people testing for Pinot, Buckskin, a couple of the Ranch War shows, but it's difficult to test. Some people will do two cards at once, but most people won't do more than two because there's just too much information. It's too easy to you know, to make a mistake on the video judging isn't the problem. Most of that's going to be the same. You know, you're going to place them the same no matter what. But the rule book tests get really tricky if you're testing for more than one association, because there's enough small discrepancies in the rule books that it's better if you can kind of read up and study up on one and pass that test and then go on to the next one. So like I said, two is about as many as people will try to do at once. But that's the way most people go about it anyway.
But that one company holds the testing for multiple breed
associations. That's correct. Yes, that's correct. And then there's a few more that do their own. It just kind of depends on the association. So there's a group that all does it through that one, the color breed. The International does a seminar in Tulsa in January. And then some of the other associations, you just kind of have to read as you're wanting to get your card and see what the requirements are. And some associations require that you've been a member for a certain number of times. Some it's 1 year, some it's 3 years. It just kind of depends. So you need to, if you think you're interested in getting a judge's card, it's important that you're reading the rules of the association to make sure that you've been a member long enough and so forth. So,
yeah, you can't just hop up one day and be like, yo, I'm going to start judging horse shows.
Right. Yes, yes. And when you hold multiple cards and so forth, too, like I try to be prepared as I'm going in to judge a show, like even if it's just an open show. As I'm coming into that show, you know, if I've got a show that weekend, then, you know, by Wednesday or Thursday, I'm, you know, going through and looking at their rule book to kind of refresh my mind. I might go on APHA just has a great resource, their whole Horse IQ program online. They've actually got classes that you can go on and take a look at and review all the penalties and stuff. So it's nice to just refresh your memory to go through some of those classes and make sure you've got all those penalties and score sheets straight in your head. So even as most carded judges, even if they've been doing this a long time, will still take the time prior to a show for a couple days and review everything so everything's fresh in their head so they're ready to make all those quick decisions.
That's pretty cool, though, because it is a lot. I mean, I dabbled a little bit in 4-H and, you know, what the hippology and horn, all that kind of ordeal. You know, we dabbled a little bit into it. It's a lot of information to one person to hold in their head, and then to be able to do it from multiple places is, you know, pretty impressive.
It is.
It's a lot.
And most judges will agree that the biggest part of judging is organization, because you really have got to be organized. If you get a class of 20 horses that comes in, you've got to be able to organize those horses somehow, you know, in a real class.
Yes.
So keeping all the numbers straight and keeping your judges' cards straight and keeping your score sheets straight and then, you know, knowing, like I said, knowing all the penalties, how the rules of the class, the organization is extremely important. And most judges are trying very, very hard to do things, you know, right. They aren't, you know, people always complain about politics and things like that. And I don't think that enters into it as much as people think.
Yeah, you know, well, I mean, you're going to have that. Some people are maybe looking for an excuse of some type, or some people, are, you know, may not necessarily like, you know, it is what it is sometimes.
Sure.
I could see that in maybe an opinion-based, kind of like an open show or a pleasure show, which you have a little bit more leeway than you do in other particular things. But, I mean, it is what it is, you know. You either do better or don't.
Yes. Yeah. The associations have really worked hard to try to put in some kind of objective scoring system for most classes. So, especially when you have to turn those score sheets into the office. Now, the open shows usually don't require it, but most of the breed shows, you turn your score sheets in. So it's pretty hard to, you know, say that horsemanship run place last when they had a perfect kivet and, you know, no penalties. And so really helps.
So you mean, people can object to, they could send in something that if they don't necessarily agree with it for certain breed shows?
No, I mean, it keeps it objective, like instead of subjective, it keeps it objective. Like you've got to judge it on a set of rules and regulations, not just what you think in your head it ought to be. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I was like, what? And I saw somewhere online, I don't know if you dabble any of the, like, ranch shows and any of that type of stuff? I saw
We've just started showing some ranch, and we're really having fun with it. In fact, we had some High Point mules in the World Ranch Association last year, so we plan to keep showing some ranch, and I think that would be, a couple of those cards would be fun to have as well, because we enjoy that.
Well, I saw where somebody, I don't know if it's true or not because I didn't look it up in the rule book, but I saw somebody where, you know, made a comment where you can't approach the judge in ranch shows. Now, again, I don't know if it's true or not because I didn't look it up.
That's true at all shows. If you were going to approach the judge, you would need to approach the ring steward, and the ring steward could address your issue and see if there was something that needed to be that could or needed to be addressed with the judge. But that's true at all shows. I couldn't believe
that, because when we were growing up, of course, it wasn't ranch and it wasn't a breed show. It was like fun shows and open shows. It was actually looked at you as it was a honorable thing to approach the judge and go, hey, what can I work on, or what is the problem, or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I was shocked to see that. I was like, I didn't know that.
I think it's more about optics, especially at the breed shows, because people are so concerned with politics and things like that. And nowadays people get so crazy. It just, by keeping that little bit of separation, it helps, you know, keep everything, the appearance of everything, to be more, you know, just a cleaner. But if you had a specific question, though, you can certainly approach the ring steward, and the ring steward can, you know, can take your question to the judge or organize a, you know, or be there after the show. But the judge should really never be alone with the exhibitors discussing things.
I get that.
Now, it's encouraged if you're, and the judge can kind of read the room at a smaller show or an open show, especially, or 4-H show. It's not looked down upon for the judge to say, hey, you had a really nice run, but, you know, if you hadn't missed that lead over there or something like that, you know, the judge can offer some suggestions that way, but that's different than someone, you know, just approaching the judge.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see what you're saying. That way it eliminates anybody saying the probability of somebody said something here, somebody did something here. It completely washes that out.
Yeah.
So do you now, okay, now you train full-time, and I know you do graphics on the side, but do you guys dabble into any sales and things of that nature? Do you do any breeding or any of that?
Yes, we do a lot of breeding. That is a big part of our program. We stand.
I didn't know this.
We do, yeah. We stand the Jack Clyde's Gallant Fox, and he's probably one of the most famous donkeys ever. He's won more than any donkey in the country. He's been the leading jack for the Maine Mule Association for 9 years, I think, in a row. I think if he wins it this year, it'll be a decade. So that's pretty exciting. So we breed. I don't breed a lot of mares of my own. I breed between 2 and 4 every year, mostly because I get so attached to them that I want to be able to do a really good job and make sure they're going to be good citizens. So with everything else I have going on, 2 to 4 is about as many as I can do a good job on, because I want to have them leading and picking up their feet and ponying. I don't like to sell babies. I usually like to wait until they're yearlings, because a lot of people see pictures of the cute mule babies and they're like, oh, I want to buy that. And then it ends up at a sale barn, you know, a few months later, because they can't handle it and they don't know what they're doing. So I like to really try to place people with my animals. So I try to get them the best home possible. But we breed a lot of outside mares. We probably breed, you know, 50 to 70 outside mares. We do a lot of mostly shipped semen, and then breed some here on the farm. We do all our own AI, shipped semen.
Keeps you pretty busy.
It does. Yep, it does. Luckily for a donkey, he collects very easy, because donkeys can be kind of finicky on the collection process. So when we're in the swing of things, I can normally collect him in about 15 minutes, which is record time for a jack. So they can make you wait an hour or two if they feel like it. So
really? Do they get all finicky?
They do. Yeah, it's not the same as a horse stallion. I mean, you can pretty much get any horse stallion collected. They just have a lot higher libido and are not near as picky. I get calls every year from people that have bought jacks and want to know how to breed them to your mare. And I'm like, well, buckle up. You might be there a while. So, because they can really just decide. Even him, it's different than a horse stallion. We do, not to get too in graphic detail, but I collect him alone. So I bring in a mare in a stall, but she doesn't have to be in heat. In fact, I can bring in a gelding as long as I have a warm body in the stall. That makes him happy. And then I collect urine from the mares that are in heat, and I keep those in syringes in the freezer. So I will get one of those syringes out with the urine and let him sniff that. And he'll just stand around sniffing urine for about 15 minutes. And then when he's ready, he'll kind of pull me towards the dummy, and he'll drop down and jump the dummy. And I collect him myself and stick him in a stall and come in the house and process the semen for shipping. So it works good.
Holy cow. And you can do that all by yourself. They make it sound like it's a big ordeal when it comes to horses and stuff. You know, you got to be careful and things of that nature.
You definitely have to be careful. I mean, the good part about what I'm doing is I have, that Jack has always lived at my, I've had him since he was a 2-year-old. He actually belonged to Dwayne and Samantha Francis in Missouri. They bought him and were a customer of ours and sent him to us for training as a 2-year-old. And then just in the last, I think it was 2 years ago, they decided to get out of the business, and they actually, gifted him to us, because they just really care about his welfare, and he's always lived with us, and so we own him now. But we've done all the training and collection and stallion management on him his whole life. And but he's just an exceptional individual. He lives with another horse gelding, so he doesn't have to live a solitary stallion life. And I think that helps him too. So he's happy. And like I said, he's had so much training, and we were just really careful when we started with the collection process, how we did things. Like, we use a different halter when we're going to collect him. He goes in a different part of the barn when we're going to collect him. So he knows when I go get him and put that breeding halter on him and we make that turn to go on that side of the barn, he knows what his job is. And, you know, I never forget that he's a stallion. You can't, to keep yourself safe, but he is very safe, and very easy. So, like I said, you wouldn't, I just drop the rope when he jumps the dummy. I just drop the rope and collect him. And when he's done, he quietly walks back to his stall, and he knows what he's supposed to. He knows his job. So he makes my job easy.
Yeah, like, my job's done. Can I get a cookie now?
Yep, exactly. Exactly. So.
And you don't have any plans on retiring him if he hits 10 years, you know.
No, year. We sure don't. No, we don't. We retired him from showing a couple of years ago just because there was nothing else to win. I mean, he won everything he could possibly win. He's in the NASMA Hall of Fame and the Bishop Mule Days Hall of Fame for showing. And he'd been off. We retired him several years ago, and we actually brought him back out and did Bishop Mule Days with him one more time for their 50th anniversary. We just thought it was fun for people. People hadn't seen him for a while because he'd been retired from showing, and he hadn't been. I legged him up for 30 days, and he still went out there and won the Western Pleasure and won the Gambler's Choice Driving. And he likes to go. Like, that's the only, my only disappointment from retiring him was he loves people. So he misses standing in the stall and having his head hanging out and all the people walking past. But he gets a lot of attention here too. So
now, obviously you've been around them for so long, you know, are they still very, like, protective of livestock? Because, you know, I heard some people will get donkeys and mules to protect their livestock. Are they like that when it comes to that type
people
of stuff?
Do that. With other horses? It's not great. There's a couple of things that doesn't work well with that. For one, donkeys nutritionally have very different requirements than most of the livestock people want to run them with. So it's kind of a sad deal. And it happens a lot here in the South. People run them with cattle, but they really shouldn't be eating most of the stuff cattle are eating. And then they usually don't get any vet or farrier care. They just kind of kick them out and forget about them. And then it's hard to find just the right donkey. I mean, donkeys are protective of themselves, so they will kind of naturally run off dogs and things like that, but they aren't. They are prey animals just like horses. So like a pack of dogs or, you know, anything bigger, like bears or mountain lions, a donkey is not going to protect your livestock from. They're just going to end up dead or ate as well.
This is why you can't believe everything on the internet.
Well, and many people have them. I mean, there'll be a bunch of people that'll call me a liar, but they end up at sale barns all the time. The other problem they have is that they get used to their own little herd. And then, like, during calving season, the cows will start having their calves. Well, they don't understand that the calves aren't a threat. That's a new strange critter in their in their pen. So a lot of times they'll kill a calf. That can be a big problem. A lot of times people will go get a donkey and think it's going to protect their herd, and they'll get to losing calves because the donkey doesn't understand that, you know, what's happening. They just think it's a new threat in their pasture that's happened, or that some of them.
Well, I always thought the same thing that you just said, that they're prey, they're still kind of along the same lines as a horse, you know, because horses are prey animals too. They're herd animals. And
absolutely.
I kind of thought the same thing too, but I just don't. I mean, I've never had a donkey, but I don't know anything about it, you know. But so I always thought it was interesting to see these people saying that kind of stuff, and you know, glad to hear you.
Well, and it's sad. And the sad part of it is most of the people, I think, especially in the South, just look at them as disposable. So, you know, they'll go, like I said, they'll buy some at a sale barn and they'll dump them out with the rest of their livestock, and they don't get their needs met. And the other thing about a donkey that I was slightly surprised by, and I shouldn't have been. I mean, horses are herd animals and so are donkeys. But donkeys are really herd animals. They get very attached and form very strong bonds with each other, and they will really pine as they change homes, and they definitely kind of need a donkey companion. So most donkey breeders will tell you, if you think you're going to buy just one, you really ought to look at buying a pair, because the donkeys really do best when they have another donkey. So for their own well-being. But like I said, a lot of times the livestock producers aren't super worried about the donkey's well-being. In fact, there was a big controversy not long ago. There's a show in Tennessee that's been going on for years and years, kind of an open, fun show called Columbia Mule Days, and they were actually going to have donkey penning. When cattle prices got so high, a lot of people started buying cheap donkeys at sale barns because they can chase them and pin them just like they would do cattle pinning. But it was cheaper to buy donkeys. But the donkeys, you kind of traumatized doing that too. And a lot of
I don't know if I like that idea.
We didn't like it at all. The donkey and mule community kind of banded together, and because the people putting it on, I think, just didn't know any better. And when the information was all presented to them, they decided not to have the event, which we were very happy about. But
yeah, I don't know if I like that, and I don't know anything about it. But to me, a donkey is not like a cow. Like, I just think that's two completely different.
Right. And down here, you see a lot of people roping donkeys. That's not great either. There's some people that will really, you know, be careful and do it right, but they just aren't really meant to be used in that way. So. So we try to look out for the donkey welfare when we can, but it's just like everything else, just requires a lot of education. And the more you get to know the donkeys, you just can't help but love them. I've never met anybody that owned that really owned a donkey that they rode and cared for that just didn't have one around forever because they are so sweet.
Right. Well, I mean, like, you just hit the nail on the head. No, you don't. People don't know. Like me, I'm sitting here. I'm the perfect example. I'm sitting here thinking to myself, okay, donkeys are cool by themselves. You can put them out with livestock. Like they're tough as nails. And I'm sitting here learning it's not like that at all.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, they really still require, people are under the misconception. And I think more so about the donkeys even than the mules. The mules are a little tougher in general. Because they're a hybrid. I think it's kind of like having a mutt dog. It just seems like the hybrid vigor in the mules takes over, and they are still susceptible to all the same, you know, diseases and ailments that horses have. It's a myth that they can't colic or they can't founder. All those same things can happen to mules. But I do think they're a little tougher. But the donkeys really aren't. The donkeys can have a lot of hoof issues. They abscess really easily. They're real thin skinned. They can have a lot of, you know, it's really easy to gall one with a girth. People do think donkeys are just tough as nails, and they really aren't. So.
Well, no, this is great to learn this because I think, I mean, you know, it's great to learn this because, you know, it's good to know for people that are wanting to get into it or consider it, and they can
for
be a little more educated and not make a bad decision.
Yes.
You know, it kind of gets sad seeing animals. Of course, I'm an animal lover. You sound like you are one, too.
Me,
you
too.
Know.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. No, they really do require the same level of care horses do. They don't, most donkeys don't eat as much, but even that needs to be considered on a case-by-case basis. So it's kind of a misconception that, you know, donkeys stay fat on air. Well, most of them do, but the ones that we've got here, you know, that are bigger, and in performance training, I mean, I've got one that we feed rice bran to on top of his, you know, to top dress on his feed to keep weight on him because he's so big. So it just, you know, it kind of varies by donkey, just like it will vary by horse. But they do all require the same care. They need their teeth floated. They need vaccinations. They need farrier work. So they're not that much more low maintenance than a horse as far as their everyday care.
Well, I would think that, I mean, if they are still in the equine family, so, I mean, if you're going to use them in a performance environment, they would still get the same treatment as a horse doing a performance job and things of that nature. So, you know, they shouldn't be looked at any different.
Right. Absolutely.
Now, okay, so just for, I think I used to know this, but I forgot because I have nothing to do with it, obviously. But a donkey is a donkey, but a mule is a mix between a donkey and a jack, right?
Correct. No? It's actually a mule would be a donkey jack, and a horse mare would produce a mule. And then if you flip that and do a donkey jenny and a horse stallion, they call that a hinny. But it's much harder to get a hinny. The chromosomes don't line up as well. It's easier to, the horses have a higher number of chromosomes than the donkey, so it's easier to breed that way and get a mule than it is the opposite way. It's just harder to get one on the ground. Most of them don't make it through pregnancy to do it the opposite way, if that makes sense. So you do see some, and you see a lot of people say they have a hinny. People think if they have a little mule with shorter ears, it's a hinny, and a lot of times that's just a pony mule. We've seen 16-hand hinnies. really, you just see mules of every shape and size. We see mules with big ears, mules with little ears, mules that look more like quarter horses, you know, mules that look like ponies, and that people just think that it's kind of an old wives' tale, but if you've got a little, you know, a little mule with little ears, it must be a henny. But most, and I, it seems like when they go through sale barns and stuff, the sale barn people like to call them hennies. I don't know if they think that makes them more special, maybe, so, or what, but I see that a lot on rescues and at sale barns, that, you know, if it's a little pony mule, it must be a henny, but it's usually not the case. Like I said, it's not impossible at all, but it's less common. So.
Right. So, well, that was another thing I wanted to ask you. So you do the driving too, right?
Yes. Yes, we sure do.
Do you like doing that? Is that scary? Is that fun?
I do like doing it. I like to do it on one I can trust. Yeah, it can be scary because we just use mostly the little, you know, Gerald type show carts like you would see at a quarter horse show. So there's no brakes or anything like that. So you definitely have to put a lot of the time in the groundwork and do your homework at home so you know that you've got one that you can trust. Yeah. So, and I've got some of my clients are get pretty worried about the driving. They do it because it's a part of the all around, but they always tell me if they have any trouble, they're going to jump out.
Yeah, that would scare me to do that. I'd be like, no, I would have to have a seasoned, been doing it for a
right.
long time to try to even attempt it.
We've been pretty lucky. I had one near wreck, and we were showing at a small show at the Dark County Fair in Ohio, and they had the arena split, and they had big draft horses on one side and the mules on the other. And I took kind of a younger mule, but I trusted her. Like, she's a very trustworthy mule, but I took her in the obstacle driving because she was in the arena by herself. And about halfway through the course, they started sending the drafts in, and they were big wagons, and they made a lot of noise. And she spooked, and she kind of ran off, but I just, my husband always says, stay in the cart, no matter what, stay in the cart.
Oh, wow.
So I kept hearing, he wasn't there that time, I was there by myself, and I kept hearing in his voice in my head, stay in the cart, and she didn't, because she just kind of took off, and she ran all over the arena, and then, like, she just kind of gathered her wits and stopped, and I gathered her back up, and I looked over at the judge, and I said, may I complete the course, just so she can't get by with that, and the judge said, do you need a minute, and I said, no, I think she's okay, she just went on and was fine, so, but it can
I don't blame her.
Yeah, it really can, it takes the right mule, and I think that's true of horses, too, that not all of them drive, they either kind of take to it or they don't. We've had a couple of mules over the years that we put in the cart, and we got them to that point where you could hook them to a cart, but it was just never something that they really enjoyed. It seems like they either take to it or they don't. My ones that drive really drive well, and they're very trustworthy, and they just get better and better. And the ones that don't like it, just you can tell they maybe are a little claustrophobic in the shaft. They never really settle. They don't like it touching their body. And then depending on the show, some associations require blinders and some don't, so that can make a difference too. Some horses and mules prefer to drive in no blinders in an open bridle, and some do better with bridle with blinders. So you know, that kind of depends on the animal and what rules you have to follow as well. But
I've always looked at it like that to me, that's considered a more advanced level of horsemanship to be able to do that. I mean, it's like what you just said, you can't just slap a cart behind a horse and think that it's going to be, or a mule, you know, whatever,
right,
and think that it's going to be okay. You've got to do a lot of work to get to that point, is what I would assume.
You do, and knowing how to adjust the harness and the cart so it fits the animal is so important. A lot of wrecks can be prevented just with properly adjusted equipment, because you don't want, you know, if you don't have your britching or your thimbles adjusted right and you go to stop and that cart runs up and hits them in the butt, or you know, how it's adjusted to keep the animal comfortable so it's not pulling on the saddle too much and it's not too high or too low or tippy. And so all that stuff makes a big difference in your safety, too. I would really recommend somebody find, if you want to do that, you know, find a mentor to work with that can really, you know, help kind of check you. Even though there's a lot of good YouTube videos and books and all that kind of stuff, there's just a substitute for having somebody professional kind of guide you through the process a little bit and just do some safety checks. Even if it's just a couple of times.
Well, because even that, all of that tack in itself could be just like a big old mess. You don't know what you're doing. That's a lot of tack to try to organize and keep right and do everything.
It is. Yes, and all the spare parts you need in case something breaks or isn't working right or whatever. But what we have found, what I think the true benefit to driving is what we have found is, like, we have some older clients that can't always ride, you know, or they might just want to ride a little bit or walk trot a little bit about the arena. but they really, you know, enjoy the driving at the show. So if we give them a safe mule, I think that's been a great place for people that maybe can't physically ride anymore. They can still go drive. So it's a way to keep them in the equine industry, and they can still, you know, really enjoy that and still compete. So that's been fun.
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, that's what we've got. A lot of our older customers drive, and that's where the donkeys are really great at too. You're just less likely to get in a wreck with the donkey. So we've really seen the growth in our industry and the donkeys, especially for the older competitors, people that no longer can think they can stick with a horse with a big move.
Yeah.
Will get along better on a donkey, because even if they, you know, even if you don't win the class or they do something you don't want them to do, it's unlikely that they're going to run off or jump out from underneath you or buck you off. So it's just that knowing that, you know, people, especially as their bodies begin to decline, knowing that they don't have to have that fear of the donkey, you know, coming apart like they might a horse, kind of gives them the confidence to stay in it, to stay in some kind of equine industry, which is huge.
Have you seen that? I mean, that just actually made me think about something. So when you guys break them there, right?
We do. Yes.
So do you see, like, when it comes to breaking a donkey or a mule versus a horse, I have never thought about this, but I would assume it probably is a lot less dramatic compared to a horse. I mean, depending obviously on the horse and all that good stuff.
It is with the donkeys. The mules are can be the same dramatic as the horse, but the donkeys are a completely different animal. The bigger problem we have with donkeys usually is getting them to go forward. So it's kind of the opposite, where the mules and the horses might be going too forward, or, you know, whatever you want. The donkeys are more likely just to stop if they don't understand something or don't know what they're doing. So getting a donkey that's got some motivation to go forward is kind of your first step in finding one that really is going to be a good trail or show partner. But like I said, it also, on the flip side of that, while it's frustrating to get them started and kind of find the right one, it's so rewarding for someone who might still have a little bit of that fear, or is getting to the age they aren't going to bounce anymore. We've seen a huge uptick in those classes at our shows. We offered a walk trot donkey amateur class for the first time ever last year at our national show, and it was huge. And people, I've seen people online buying, you know, looking for donkeys to buy so they can go compete in that division. So that's exciting, especially nowadays
cool.
When it's so tough to get the kids involved. Maybe we're looking in the wrong place. I mean, we absolutely have to have the kids in our industry to continue. But I also think we have to make it sustainable for people as they're aging out of this, because just the numbers everywhere are declining.
Oh, yeah, because, I mean, I just had a conversation with a guy last week. Horses and donkeys, all of them, riding in general, is therapeutic. It can be therapeutic for a physical therapy, mental. I mean, like, it can do a lot for you. So it can
Absolutely.
Keep you young, is what I'm trying to say.
It sure can. And even if all you can do is come brush one, I mean, I've got clients that, you know, older clients, they're having a bad day or whatever, and they're like, I just don't feel like riding, but I need to come see my animal and lay my hands on it. And, yeah, it is definitely therapeutic in all aspects.
Yeah, I actually saw a TikTok the other day where this man was talking about, he was getting way into more scientific detail of it, but the fact that comes with being around a horse and what they actually can do for the human on so many different aspects. So it's really cool to hear that the elder, because you're right, of course, we need kids, we need the youth, we're all about it. But I'm glad you brought that up, because, you know, I mean, nobody wants to get old, give me a break. So if you've got something... Yeah, I mean, if you've got something to look forward to and something that can keep you young, even Queen Elizabeth was still riding a horse. You see all them photos
right.
of her?
Yes,
you
absolutely.
Know.
No, I think it definitely keeps you engaged and keeps you young and keeps things working. So, no, I think it's great.
Well, that's a good avenue for the donkeys, to give donkeys something to do so people stop being mean to the donkeys.
It is. Yes, it really is. And you know, I think as you age too, you know, competitively, your mind changes. It's not that you still don't want to win, but maybe you understand it's not all about winning. So I think that age division is a little more forgiving of the donkeys too. If they make a mistake or don't go, it's kind of more funny than, you know, people don't get so angry.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can probably relate to this. In the pleasure world, it can be really perfection based and be really the outfits and all that kind of stuff. Da, 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 da.
Right.
It's cool to kind of see, well, I've talked about this many times, you know, the ranch aspects are coming up and different events and things that people can do that I don't want to say make it laid back and less competitive, because they are very, very competitive, but
right.
it's more, not welcoming environment, but it's a little more laid back, and it's not it as, is. Like you just said, so much about winning. It's a little bit more about.
Well, and I think, too, everyone that rides a mule and donkey will tell you it's just a matter of time before you get humbled because they're thinkers. It's, like I said, it's not because of their stubbornness, but because they're thinkers. There is not one person that has ridden a mule or a donkey for any length of time that has not been humbled at some point. And everyone knows that. So when you're in the show arena and something happens, everybody just kind of laughs about it because you're like, oh, it was your turn today. So I think that keeps the atmosphere at the Mule and Donkey shows a little more lighthearted, too, because everybody understands. You know, once in a while, we'll have somebody come over from the quarter horse world, and, you know, the first few shows they're out, they're super uptight, and they're trying to get this perfection and all that, and then sooner or later, something happens, and they get humbled like the rest of us, and they kind of go, oh, this is why everybody
and every horse fun. Person I mean, should ride a donkey.
Yeah, no, it really does. It just humbles you. And that doesn't mean like you've been bucked off or something, but like
right.
I said, it could be that
right.
It could be you're in the middle of the raining pattern and the donkey decides he's loped as many circles as he's gonna lope today. And at that point you tip your hat to the judge and say, thank you. He's not going any further. And you know. And that doesn't happen often, but it keeps you on your toes a little more. They just are less robotic. Than the horses are. Like I said, it makes it both fun and also a challenge because they are always thinking.
Well, I mean, that's cool. I mean, I think that's really cool because some aspects of the horse industry, like you just said it perfectly, the horse is viewed as a machine and a robot. And not saying certain people need to be humbled, but maybe that is what needs to happen because, you know, I think a lot of people forget, even a donkey, but a horse can kill you if they wanted to.
That's right.
And
yep.
People tend to forget that, and I think sometimes we've just got a lot of horses that are either just so beaten down into submission, not necessarily physically, but into submission, and people forget about what the horse actually does. They don't have to do the stuff we make them do.
That's right. And I think that's one of the things that I've really enjoyed about the mules and donkeys is, you know, I grew up, I don't ever remember not riding. I grew up in a horse family. I rode before I spoke, probably, and so I've had some great bonds with horses over the years, but the mules and donkeys especially really bond to their person. In fact, the other day I was at a show and my husband was at home and I needed him to bring a couple of yearlings in the barn for me that I've been working with, and I can go out and catch them anytime, anywhere. In fact, I've got one that follows me down the driveway when I drive out with my truck. And he called me and he said, I can't catch those two yearlings. And I said, what do you mean? And he's a horse guy too. Don't get me wrong. I mean, he knows what he's doing. And he said, they won't let me anywhere near them. And I said, well, I just can't believe that. I said, they meet me at the gate every night. I said, you know, and he's like, wait a second. He said, just keep talking. And they could hear me on the phone. And because they could hear me on the phone, they let him get a hold of them, let him put the halter on. And then so I had to keep talking to him. So he said, it's so funny. They'll give you the side eye. You know, they looked at him like, we don't know who you are. We don't trust you, but we can hear mom on the phone. So maybe you're okay. So we've had now ours, once you get them to the point that they're really broke, most of them, like we have, all of my clients really want the industry to grow. So a lot of times they share some of their mules with different youth kids and things like that. So once we get them broke, you can kind of put anybody on them and they'll get along with them and things like that. But they still really do have their people. It's always funny to see how they'll interact with different people and the bonds they form, you know, the longer you've got one. It is pretty amazing.
That's pretty cool. That's cool if they remember that because, I mean, the more you talk about it, the more you're just basically saying, not that they're smarter than the horse, but they think a lot more, and it's challenging to the rider.
Yes. Yeah, you definitely, I mean, with horses, you definitely have to be careful with too much repetition, you know, and practicing a lot of your patterns for the anticipation, but that's
right.
A lot more so even with the mules, where I was very careful with the mules not to over practice things because you can really build the anticipation into them, and that's true for horses too, but the mules, you just multiply it because they figure it out so quickly. They're like, oh, okay, over here, we do a pivot over here, and they get ahead their rider really easily.
Oh, well, that's super cool. And so do you now you raise the baby sare and you breed your jack sare and all that kind of good stuff, obviously you've probably already gotten a market of clients that you work with and stuff like that. How do you deal with, let's say you get new people that come in from the horse world, you get a lot of people like that are wanting to kind of move over to the donkey and mule side, and do you have to kind of, how do those interactions go?
Sure, we do some. One thing that we've had several different avenues for mules to kind of get them out in the horse world, which has been good. The Pinno Horse Association has started accepting long ears in their association, so we can actually have a long ear division and earn Pinno points and compete at like Pinno Congress and for their year-end awards and so forth. So that has really opened us up to a lot of horse people because we saw with them, we're in the arenas with them, you know, competing. So that's really brought a lot of curiosity over to it. And then a lot of people going out in the ranch shows, and we've got some youth kids that are competing in different areas. The Western dressage world has been really popular. We've seen some mules really excel there and really kind of open horse people up to it. But yeah, we try to bring people over to the dark side.
That's really cool, by the way.
If I can get somebody interested, you know, I've got some broke ones that I really trust, and I'm like, hey, step on. You know, if you've ever ridden one, why don't you step on? And so I'll, you know, we might let somebody ride one to get the feel of it, or kind of, you know, we want to build that excitement for our industry because it's a real niche market for sure. So we want it to continue to build it and for it to continue to grow. I think the single biggest challenge facing us is just the number of really broke mules available. Because if I just woke up this morning and decided I wanted to go, you know, buy a quarter horse Western pleasure horse, I could go find one. By the end of today, I could find one. I mean, if I had the money to spend or whatever, I could find one. That's not necessarily true with the mules. I mean, to go find a broke show mule is like finding a needle in the haystack. So I think that's the biggest challenge of our industry is, even if I have people call me and say, hey, I have the money to spend. You know, I have a lot of money to spend. Find me a broke show mule. They're just not available. When people get them, they don't ever turn loose of them. They keep them forever. You just don't.
Do you think it's harder to train them? Is it less? Because you just hit on a good point. I mean, is it less? Obviously, it's less product out there to buy for people. But is it less actually people to support it?
There's less people doing it, and of course, it's smaller in general. So it's hard to get more people doing it unless there's enough people, you know, buying the end product to support it. So it is kind of a catch-22. So. It just requires a lot bigger time commitment because really if you wanted a finished animal, you know, especially a show animal, there's a lot of trail animals to go buy, but not as many show mules. Your best bet is to buy a young one, to buy a nice yearling or 2 year old that you really like and put it in training. But then you've got that time, you know, that time commitment. And a lot of the people that have the money to spend that want to do it right now don't want to, you know, are getting up there in age and don't want to wait for them. They want to go show one right now. So that is a challenge that I'm not exactly sure how we're going to overcome. Because like I said, when people get a good one, they keep them forever. You don't see the turnover in mules like you do in the horses. I mean, people, especially on the show mules, almost you can look back through the last couple decades of show mules, and most of those show mules that were earning points and winning with that person still live with that person or have, you know, lived their entire life there until they die. So,
you're right. You're very, very right on that. And then also, so what is your let's say you can make a show horse, technically speaking, you could get a good start on a horse and put them in a show within, you know, 90 days. Let's just be generous, I guess. How long would it take for you to do that with a mule?
You're looking at probably closer to a year to 8 months to a year to really have one. It does. The beginning just takes more time for sure.
That's probably what it is. People don't want so many people, especially now in the industry, maybe not back in the day, but now it's so much like right now. I want to finish product right now. And that's a difficulty for you guys.
It is. And the number of shows, although I think that that's less limiting because there are so many, there's very few places now, especially in the open show world and the ranch show world, that you can't also show horses with the mules. So that helps because we have a limited number of just mule shows. There's only so many people to spend the money to put them on and that kind of thing. Right. So we have a mule circuit that we follow, but you've kind of got to travel. It's not like I can just go show mules at a mule show in Oklahoma, like our next show coming up. Well, we'll go to Tulsa and show at the Pinno show this next weekend because they've got mule classes. But then the next show we go to is in Bishop, California. So, and then after that, we'll come back and go to our national show in Tennessee. So it's not unusual for us to have to drive, you know, 10 to 12 hours to go to a regular show. So
that's sporadic
too. Yes, it is. So now, like I said, you can show, there's a lot of open show and ranch horse and almost all the 4-H states, you know, state 4-H and stuff take them now. So there's a lot of other opportunities to show, but to really want to compete, you know, with just the mules, it's a little more difficult. You've kind of got to travel around to go to those places.
Well, yeah, that's what I was fixing to say. Well, that's when I first saw a pleasure mule was in 4-H, but now you can't get breed points in 4-H. So
correct.
It hinders you still because you can't necessarily, if you want to do like, you know, a breeding program and things of that nature, you're going to want to get the results and the numbers and stuff, which, you know, 4-H will hinder you there. So
that's right. Yep, that's right. So,
well, hopefully more people will start kind of coming around, especially if there's a lot to, you know, if it's coming up and you've got more to choose from, especially with the donkeys being out there and people wanting to turn them over and stuff, you know, hopefully that'll help grow it a little bit.
Yeah, I hope so too. I think the more we can just get them out in the world and the more we can get them in front of people and, like I said, let people see their big personalities and that kind of thing, then, you know, the bigger we can make it. So,
or at least have it coincide with horses. To be able to have a class where at a breed show where you can show both mules and horses, I don't see why that wouldn't be a problem.
Right, right. Yeah, even Pinna, we still show separately. Like, we can't show with the horses. We have our own mule classes, which limits it just a little bit for them. Now, they do take us, like, they've got, at Color Breed Congress, they have a few kind of cash classes, kind of jackpot classes, and they do let the mules show in that, which is fun. And they and a lot of the mules have placed very well in those classes.
Yeah.
So,
but why do you think they still keep it separated? I mean, why do you think that still is? Why haven't they just, because to me, it's, I don't want to say they're the same, but they basically are the same. It's not.
Right. I think there's still a lot of discrimination against them. I mean, there's still a lot of horse people that don't want them there.
Right.
So now it's gotten way better over the years. And normally it's just they don't know or they, because I have not seen a big reaction. I think, you know, the horse people get used to kind of controlling the environment and things like that, and they think their animals are going to be afraid of the mule and donkeys, and we've not seen that much. Usually if we see a horse having a reaction, they're already very reactive. You know, they're already afraid of that thing over there and afraid of that guy's dog, and, you know, the mule is just one more thing. But we hauled around a youth kid very successfully for a while in a lot of 4-H shows, and we just saw very little problem mixing them in. But there is still some discrimination that way. I mean, I would love it, like, if we could someday, you know, go to the NSBA World Show and show alongside the horses and things like that. And maybe we'll get there eventually. I mean, I think you're already seeing breed shows, you know, do a lot of combining just to get the numbers to make it to work for everybody, just because the equine, you know, world in general has gotten smaller.
Well, yeah, they're missing out on their own money.
Right. Yep. So we may see that change going forward as people just start looking for more numbers. But the more positive interactions we can get the mule and donkeys out in the world having positive interactions, the better it is for our industry, and hopefully we'll just continue to grow it. So